Hey, this is Randall Foster from Symphonic Distribution. You are listening to Your Morning Coffee, the podcast with my friends Jay Gilbert and Mike Etchart. Weekly music news for the new music business.
For music business worldwide, a new music-only subscription tier is coming to Spotify, confirms Daniel Ek, and four other things we learned on the company's latest earnings call.
From Billboard, a guest column by our friends Will Page and Fred Goldring, how vinyl can harness the influence of superfans.
And also from Billboard, Luminate expands how it counts indie retail sales for Billboard charts via new partnership. Looking like we got a lot of stuff to talk about today, Jay. We're glad you're here. And I think Jay and I are going to push the start button right about now.
Stand by for transmission.
This is London calling.
Wake up! The revolution is at hand!
Your morning coffee is on the air.
Your morning coffee, the weekly music news for the new music business. It's the highly curated, agitated, advocated, moderated, and liberated digital music information that you need to know. We are your digital music authority. And now, from our studios in Hollywood, California, here's your hosts, Jay Gilbert and Mike Etchart.
Well, a groovy good day, everyone. Welcome to the podcast, and a groovy good day to you, Jay Gilbert. It's been nice to see you, sir.
Thank you, my friend. So much great stuff to talk about this week. But before we jump in, before we hit record, you and I were talking about some music books that we'd been reading. And one of them that I'm about halfway through that I'm really enjoying is the title of the book is 1999, The Year the Record Industry Lost Control. And it's by Amon Ford, and you'll remember Amon. We've had him on the podcast. He wrote that really great book, "Leaving the Building: The Lucrative Afterlife of Music Estates." Mm-hmm. Big book, long read, but really great stuff. And the other one that you and I were talking about, I haven't read this yet, but I want to. He wrote a book called "The Final Days of EMI: Selling the Pig."
Yeah, boy, I remember seeing that it is out. But I've got to get it, you know, having worked at EMI. And there's been a couple of, in the past, there's been some good EMI books focusing on different eras. And yeah, I need to get this one.
When were you at EMI?
I was at EMI from, not for all that long, from 98 and 99 I was at EMI. Before I came to Universal, I was at EMI. Yeah, so lots of great EMI stories. And of course, you'll remember the in fact, one of the books referred to EMI, the acronym meaning every mistake imaginable.
Ouch.
I know. So, right. And I saw some of that, to be honest. And in the day, it was interesting because EMI, of course, was so huge in outside of the U.S. They could never really get their act together in the U.S. And when I was at Warner's, many of the great EMI acts in the U.K. they didn't want to be on Capitol in the States, so they were through the Warner Music Group. And so it's an interesting history. I'd love to read the book. That's going to be my next one I will read after my Leon Russell book that I'm reading right now.
Yeah, I want to hear the rest of that. And then, you know, I'll let you know how the rest of this book goes. But again, the year the record industry lost control, 1999, that's by Amon Ford. Another great thing we were talking about is from our friend Bobby Osinski over at the Music 3.0 blog. There was a story that caught my eye. The headline was "Musical Paralysis Happens a Lot Younger Than You Think." And you and I talk about this, like, when do most people sort of stop listening to new music? And Bobby points out that unless you're a teenager, you've probably noticed that, you know, taste for discovering new music stagnates as we age. Musical paralysis is real, and it disturbs many adults. We feel their love for music has decreased as they age. There are a lot of studies, you know, that back that feeling up, but sometimes the best data comes from the streaming platforms that actually service the music we listen to.
Yeah, exactly. So a New York Times review of Spotify data discovered that our musical preferences are set by what we listen to between the ages of 13 and 16 years old. In fact, for female listeners, this is set more deeply set than in males. What's more, a YouGov survey found that what we consider the best decade in music is largely dependent upon the era that we grew up. And there's a wonderful a graphic here. It says music of a lifetime. When do the strongest adult musical preferences set in? Well, for women, it's age 13. For men, it's a bit later, age 14. But they show a graph of your different ages from birth through age 30. And then the influences on your musical preferences. And there it is, peaking in women right around 14. And it does kind of stay a little bit higher at age 30. But at men, it peaks at age 14. And then by age 30, they're back to where they were almost at the beginning of birth.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's just interesting. And that's sort of reflected in a lot of friends that I grew up with. You know, it's they really just still kind of like the stuff from high school,
yeah,
early high school or middle school in this case. So yeah. Really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, and they
really
pulled that, you know, from streaming data. So, by the way, check out Bobby Osinski's Music 3.0 blog, one of our favorite places to go. Last week, you and I were talking about some of the news from the Mechanical Licensing Collective, mm-hmm. the MLC. And so this last week, I talked to Chris Arend. And Chris serves as the chief executive officer for the MLC, where he sort of leads the organization's mission to ensure that songwriters, composers, lyricists, and music publishers receive their mechanical royalties from streaming and download services in the U.S., that they get that, you know, accurately and on time. I had the chance to talk to him about some of their recent milestones. And I also asked him to sort of give a quick overview of what the MLC is for those that don't know. Always a pleasure talking to Chris. Let's listen in. Chris Arend, so good to see you. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Jay, great to see you too.
So a couple of questions. One, assume the listener has no prior knowledge of the Mechanical Licensing Collective. Give us a quick overview of the MLC, how it was created, and the work that you do.
Sure. We were created by an act of Congress, the Music Modernization Act, which was passed back at the end of 2018. We started to build the company out in January of 2020, right before COVID. We continued working during the height of COVID and launched full operations in January of 21. And so we've now been operating for a little over 3 years. And our primary, really sole mission is to process and then distribute mechanical royalties to songwriters and their publishing partners. Mechanicals are one of the sets of rights and then resulting royalties that that go to songwriters and their publishing partners.
So we've been seeing the MLC in the news a lot in the last month or so. Tell us about some of your recent milestones.
Sure. Well, one of the big ones a few months ago was that our total royalties distributed crossed $2 billion. It's a pretty big milestone, again, to think we've been doing this for a little over 3 years and now I've hit that mark for total royalties distributed. So really exciting, really proud for our team, and just, I think, a real great indication of the wisdom in the law that Congress provided all of us.
Fantastic. Well, keep up the great work. Hope to bump into you at Music Biz.
Looking forward to seeing you there too, along with everybody else that comes down.
All right. Take care. We'll talk soon.
Take care, Jay. Yep. Bye.
This is a world that it's deep music business stuff, right? It's not, you know, and a lot of people in the business that whose livelihood is music don't really quite understand how this all works.
It's inside baseball. It's how the sausage is made. But you have to know these things if you're going to be in the business. The music industry, we often say, is complex by design. And it's people like Chris that sort of demystify some of that stuff for us.
Yes, I need a demystifier in my life all the time. Another great point thing from Patrick Clifton and his Tunes and Tales blog, notes on the fan economy, why fans have always been important, how tech will drive the future, and what pitfalls may appear as fandom develops.
Yeah, fandom is defined in the dictionary as a state or condition of being a fan of something or someone. In the music industry conversation, it refers to the economic opportunity presented by fans and fan communities. It's an oft-discussed buzzword which has prompted a lot of conversation in the music industry community over the last couple of years.
Right, so fandom isn't new, and as in prior phases in its evolution, technology will be a critical driver of change. Scale will determine the winners and losers, as will a healthier attitude towards fans as primary stakeholders in the music value chain rather than as a resource to be exploited. Well, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had a chance to talk to Patrick this last week. He's one of our favorite guests. You have to check out his blog, Tunes and Tales. It's absolutely the best. Here's that conversation with Patrick. Patrick, thank you for joining me. Always good to see you.
It's great to see you too, Jay. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I really loved your piece. We ran it in your morning coffee last week. Notes on the fan economy. So good. You wrote that fandom is often held up as a new trough for the industry to feed on, a resource to exploit. Talk about the super fan and sort of this new fan economy.
Yeah, okay. Thanks a lot, Jay. And as always, if anyone wants to check out the story, you can find my blog, medium.com/@tunesandtales. And I write about a few other things there and been very pleased to come and talk to you about it on the show. Yeah, so look, you know, we've had this situation where there's been a sort of 10-year ascendancy in streaming revenues for the industry and this like really fast and steep growth curve. And everyone's been incredibly excited about that, you know, especially the shareholders of major global music corporations. And, you know, as you'll know, like any corporation that's listed on the stock exchange is every quarter having to report on their current performance, but also always be talking about where they think the future growth is going to come from. And investors, you know, are pricing in future opportunity and future revenue, future opportunity for incremental revenue into the share price. So consequently, to maintain your share price, you have to be giving investors confidence that there's more money to come down the road. And we've seen, obviously, streaming revenues begin to decelerate in terms of their growth. They're still growing, but they're not growing at like 30%, the sort of 30% growth rates that we saw in the late, you know, sort of 2016 to 2021 period. And so everyone's looking for the new thing that's going to help kind of kick the growth curve back up into positive territory. And so what a lot of people have been talking about is the fan opportunity and especially super fans. So a super fan is, you know, I've always understood a super fan to be essentially the top segment of your fan base that is prepared really to take more actions and spend more money than the rest. And there's been lots of different numbers thrown out there about you know, how much of any average fan base is a super fan. I think the reliable one I saw that I think Spotify said about their streaming audience was the top 5% of any particular sort of large artist fan base would be responsible for 80% of the streams. So I think I've seen similar numbers to that, and that feels about accurate to me. And so, yeah, the new fan economy is essentially efforts to try and, you know, corral all those fans and access their wallet in a unitary way, as opposed to this disparate way that kind of exists really at the moment with, you know, ticketing happening in one area, merchandise potentially another, recorded music in another. And I guess also having the intelligence, the data in a centralized fashion around those fans to be able to kind of monetize that relationship in a more intelligent way.
Yeah. Tell me about what you've learned about things like expanded rights and some of the, you know, like the evolution of Label 360 deals versus some of the D2C options that you point out in the piece.
Yeah. You know, historically, if we go back to around like 2007, 2008, when the industry was in, the recorded industry was in real trouble with the file sharing, the kind of death of the CD album, all of that stuff. Labels were you know, in an existential kind of crisis and really needing to find ways to shore up their revenues streams. And so at the time they were saying, well, look, we're spending all the money on marketing you, the artist, as a brand, but we're only getting this dwindling return. And so we'd like to have a share of more of your rights. And the idea of the 360 degree deal was born, whereby they would take a piece, a smaller piece of everything, plus a larger piece of recordings. And then, you know, they started to roll this out, but at the time never really built the capability to like properly execute that. So they were slow to invest in, you know, acquiring merch companies, for instance. They never really got any part of the way into the ticketing business. And then, you know, streaming came along and started to really, you know, accelerate, as we were talking about before. And record labels' finances suddenly looked a lot better. And it seems to me at that point, the impetus to kind of drive these deals through went away. But they've still been asking for those expanded rights. And that still forms a part of recording contracts. My understanding from lawyer friends of mine is a lot of those expanded rights become kind of, you know, bargaining tools or leverage points in the negotiation around around different areas, like potentially the term or the royalty structure. However, now, you know, there's a lot of new service offerings available to kind of, what's the word, capture the opportunity more fully. And I talk about that in my piece. There's a ton of innovation, especially in the tech space, around these different companies that are able to capture one or more aspect of the artist-fan relationship, be it someone like OpenStage and CRM, Vakana, who are talking about becoming a social platform connecting artist to fan, another one called Planet Fan, some guys who are London-based that I met last week or more in the ticketing space. And I think that's all great. And there's obviously, it seems like there's a lot of investor money in there. But when I think back to, you know, again, around the time of sort of end of MySpace, beginning of Facebook and Twitter, around the same time as 360 deals were coming along, that was a time, again, there was a lot of innovation and lots of new tech platforms that were there to kind of build communities, which musicians started to use. And the problem with them at that time was like this really disparate landscape, and you're asking a fan to go to six different places to engage with you as an artist. And I think that feels like a risk for me for some of these new services at the moment. And I wonder in my piece whether we might see, I mean, obviously it's a lot easier to integrate services now, and we're much more used to with our phones and lots of different apps, switching between apps, but still it all creates friction. So I do wonder whether we'll see either some really good integration partnerships become a thing that has to happen, or some acquisition between some of those services, like, you know, buying someone to build out a capability set that they don't currently offer. And fundamentally, you know, I think we'll see the same thing happen where there'll be, you know, some of those services will gain scale as big artists come on board and bring their fan bases with them. And then unfortunately others won't be able to kind of stay in touch. So that's my, you know, kind of very rudimentary prediction.
Yeah, your piece was very timely, because there's been a lot written recently about super serving the super fan. But in your piece, you also warn that there's a potential disaffection and fan fatigue. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, like I remember reading a piece somewhere, probably about 6 months ago. And at the time I was like embroiled in a a row with my broadband internet provider, where my like monthly subscription had gone from like £25 to £58. I was furious about this, right? And this is a common practice for any business that has a long-term, that works on long-term relationships with a customer, especially where there's a subscription, where they kind of exploit the loyalty of the existing customer to subsidize their efforts to market to a new customer. And kind of, you know, most people are infuriated by that. And I feel like that there's a real danger that that's going to happen with the fan economy if we're not really, really careful. And actually, when we think about the fact that this is music, this is a cultural product that drives an emotional connection between human beings and an artist, another human being that creates something really special. Actually, and if we also believe that, you know, the top 5% of those are really, really valuable and potentially really happy to like spend a lot of money on that relationship, then we should really look after those people and try and be really careful not to be sort of very exploitative. And, you know, it's like, what can we dream up that actually sort of, you know, creates really special events or really special moments or occasions or really amazing products that we give for free to those super fans, as opposed to like just going there to just make more money by throwing, you know, another bunch of different colored formats or, you know, a VIP ticket that's $200 more than the standard ticket, you know, because I think if we continue to do that, people are just going to get fed up eventually.
Yeah. Patrick Clifton, Tunes and Tales, really enjoyed your piece, Notes on the Fan Economy. Keep up the great work. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Jay. Take care.
Yeah, good stuff.
Super
good
insightful. Stuff. And we really enjoy having him on, and I never miss any of his posts. So thank you, Patrick. That was great. The other thing before we jump into the stories that I wanted to talk about, and I know, look, this piece is behind a paywall, and I had some folks reach out to me, and they were really disappointed that they couldn't see it. I subscribe to the Washington Post. I love their coverage. So, you know, I did get to see this beautiful piece online, and it's, you saw it too, Mike. I mean, you know, with the beautiful videos that they have, these sort of looping videos and graphics, and it was really well done. It was written by Rachel Lerman, but the photography and the videos were by Kate Dearman, again, Washington Post. The headline was, "Artists Are All In on Vinyl. See how records are made in 2024.
So a 12-inch vinyl record can hold about 44 minutes of music, but manufacturing one can take multiple days, a complex but delicate process involving sapphires, rubies, and silver. Music fans may love the immediacy of streaming music, but that hasn't stopped them from bringing vinyl records mainstream. Revenue from vinyl jumped 10% to $1.4 billion in 2023 and outsold CDs for the second time since 1987, according to the Recording Industry Association of America.
That's right. Artists like Taylor Swift, Beyonce, Casey Musgraves, they're all leaning in, releasing vinyl albums with new color variants, you know, different art, and sometimes exclusive tracks. Last week, the Washington Post visited Nashville's United Record Pressing, which made the first Beatles single, you know, in the U.S. back in 1963, to witness the 2024 vinyl making process and watch a Tyler, the Creator record get pressed.
Right. So check out the full story to find out how records are made. You'll need to subscribe to the Washington Post for access. But man, it was lovely. And, you know, they could have made it if they had that stuff in black and white. And we were talking about this before we hit record. It looks kind of like turn of the century Industrial Revolution stuff. You know, it's the processes, right. The materials, the all of the things that are there look just so steampunky old, and it's really a complex process.
I think that steampunk thing is so accurate. It just looks retro and futuristic at the same time, if that's a thing. And a client took me on a private guided tour of RTI, which stands for Record Technology Inc. RTI is in Camarillo, which is right between my place and your place here in Southern California. They have, you know, they've been pressing 12-inch records for over 52 years. And it was really mind-blowing when you actually get to see how that's made. And we're going to cover a story in a second, written by our friends Will Page and Fred Goldring. And the headline is How Vinyl Can Harness the Influence of Superfans. And it's a thing, and it's really exciting that the industry is starting to take this format seriously as, you know, maybe not the consumption of music, because as Will points out, you know, half the people that buy vinyl don't own a turntable, but really more as that fandom piece. And, you know, I went to Record Store Day last week and grabbed some things, and it's just reminds me of that growing up, you know, buying those early albums and how thrilling that was to read those liner notes and have something that you can touch and feel.
Well, and I've done that same tour as well. And I went with the late Doug Sachs, who was one of the, you know, preeminent mastering engineers who really was a vinyl guru. He and Bernie Grundman and Bob Ludwig. So, you know, there's a handful of guys out there. Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, people don't really grasp still, I don't think, how complex of a process it is. And it's dirty. It's dangerous. There's a lot of machinery in there, and it's really complex, and it's old school manufacturing, you know, and so many people, you know, in between the fade out when we were just coming into the business to the resurgence of vinyl, a lot of people retired that understood that process. So there's been a lot of just kind of relearning on how it's done and improving the process. It's fascinating.
And I'm finding that a lot of these pressing plants don't have new state-of-the-art equipment. Some of them do, but some of them are using the machines that were used back in the day. So if you really want to get into this, I highly recommend it. It's in the Washington Post. You'll see the story in your morning coffee, but they just did a fantastic job of, you know, showing how that sausage is made. It's super cool.
That's right. Speaking of sausage being made, we couldn't make this sausage without the help of our sponsors. We certainly appreciate all the folks that help bring it to the party. So including our good friends over at Bandzoogle for over 20 years, I should say. Bandzoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website and online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional single-page electronic press kit in minutes. All the features you need to design an EPK are already built in, including fully customizable templates, preset EPK page layouts, music players, images, text bio and video embeds, a gig calendar and press quotes, and access to Bandzoogle's award-winning support team 7 days a week. The new EPK plan starts at just $6.95 per month, and your Morning Coffee podcast listeners can go over to Bandzoogle.com to try it free for 30 days, then use the promo code MorningCoffeeEPK. EPK, all one word, to get 10% off the first year of the new EPK plan subscription. That's Bandzoogle.com, promo code MorningCoffeeEPK when you sign up to the EPK plan.
Yeah, and a special thank you to Hypebot. Since 2004, Hypebot has chronicled the new music industry and the trends and technologies that are changing how music is discovered, consumed, marketed, and monetized. Edited daily by founder Bruce Houghton, with help from Alana Bonilla, Hypebot and sister blog Music Think Tank are published by live music discovery and marketing platform Bands in Town. And check out the Music Biz Weekly podcast last week. We, Mike Branvold and I, we interviewed Bruce Houghton, and we had a really great conversation.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, we're big fans and big friends of Bruce and Hypebot.
Indeed. And Bands in Town, over 80 million live music fans trust Bands in Town to get personalized concert alerts, recommendations, and messages from their favorite artists. It's the number one artist service platform, connecting over 590,000 artists with their superfans. Managers, labels, agencies, and artists access their own dashboard to manage and promote their tour dates across all platforms.
And finally, the Music Business Association. You and I were just talking about this. The Music Biz Conference is coming up, you know, and it really creates the rooms in which the important conversations that shape this music industry take place. It represents over 90% of the music industry at large. The Music Business Association serves as the connective tissue for the global music business and provides a trusted forum where ideas and collaboration can flourish. So join us for the Music Biz 2024 conference, May 13th through the 16th in Nashville. I'll be moderating a panel with some very smart music marketers. Come by and say hi.
Indeed. Big thanks to Bandzoogle, Hypebot, Bands in Town, and the Music Business Association. And boy, this neither the newsletter nor the podcast would happen without the head sausage maker, Jay Gilbert. He is a music industry consultant, the curator of the weekly Your Morning Coffee newsletter, a former executive with Universal Music, Sony Music, and Warner Music Groups, to name just a few.
Head sausage maker. I'm going to add that. That's great. And I'd like to thank my cohort, partner in crime, brother from another mother, sitting across from me, Mike Etchart, longtime host of Sound and Vision Radio, formerly of SST Records, Warner Music, Capital EMI, and Universal Music Groups.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. Well, let's jump into the stories, Jay. The first one is from Music Business Worldwide. This is by Daniel Tensor. A new music-only subscription tier is coming to Spotify, confirms Daniel Ek, and four other things we learned on the company's latest earnings call. Spotify just confirmed that it is indeed launching a newly stratified menu of subscription tiers, including audiobook-only and music-only options.
Yes, sir. During the Sweden-headquartered company's Q1 earnings call last week, co-founder and CEO Daniel Ek addressed his firm's plans to create a more flexibility when it comes to subscription plans offered to consumers. He said, "We want to offer as much flexibility as possible in this next stage of Spotify. Because we're at the size where we want to appeal to an even larger base of consumers to turn one of our subscription offerings," he said.
And he goes on, "So that obviously means that you'll see things like, for instance, the audiobook-only tier. You should expect to see a music-only tier as well. News of a forthcoming basic, aka music-only subscription tier at Spotify, offering just music and podcasts, but not audiobooks, was first broken by Bloomberg earlier this month."
Yeah, when that launches, it'll sit alongside the new audiobooks access tier, aka audiobooks only, which recently launched in the U.S. at $9.99 per month. Subscribers to this tier don't get Spotify Premium access. They can get access, you know, to an ad-supported music experience. The new menu of plans at Spotify is, of course, at the center of a fiery industry debate right now.
Fiery indeed. But aside from the new subscription tiers coming to Spotify, here are four other things we learned on the company's latest earning calls. Number one, Spotify no longer considers itself just a music company, but a multi-channel content company. At various times during the call, Ek highlighted the idea that Spotify is expanding well beyond being a music streaming service.
Well, that's hardly news, but given its expansion into podcasts, audiobooks, and videos years ago, what's notable here is that Spotify CEO suggested that the future subscriber and top-line growth will depend not so much on an increasing number of music listeners on the platform, but rather an increasing of the number of consumers of other types of content.
So he said, Spotify isn't just a sort of one-trick pony anymore, but it is actually multiple verticals working together to provide a consistent, great story around more and more choice for consumers, which drives more and more engagement. You may come for the music and stay for the audiobooks, and some consumers may come for the podcasts and stay for the audiobooks. There are going to be more ways for people to interact with it.
He noted at one point during the call that more than 25% of Spotify's user base now engages with audiobooks, which begs an interesting question for the music industry, right? How much of Spotify's impressive increase in paying subscribers over the past year wasn't about music?
Another second thing that we learned, Spotify wants to beat TikTok on music discovery, and it's planning to expand short video content to do it. The U.S. appears, of course, to be inching ever closer towards forcing ByteDance to divest its holdings in TikTok or see TikTok banned from its U.S. app stores. Asked on the earning call whether a U.S. TikTok ban would be good for Spotify, Ek declined to comment on other companies and their strategy or what may happen with their regulatory proceedings.
Yeah, but he made it clear that he sees TikTok as a competitor in the short-form video platform has become a major focal point of the music industry. Quote, "We are focused on winning discovery, and we're going to add as many ways that we can to improve discovery on Spotify."
Right, he said, "You saw us in the quarter add music videos. You're going to see music clips in a bigger way. You can already today, if you open up the app, start seeing more and more videos on the music side where artists are engaging with fans in a similar way to the Reels product that TikTok did a few years ago." He also added, "Short form music content is a big focus of ours.
Spotify launched a new short-form video feature. It's called Clips on its platform a little more than a year ago. It also launched a new tool called Countdown Pages, where artists can promote new releases through exclusive video clips, pre-save buttons, and tracklist previews. The feature also comes with a countdown timer for releases.
So a third thing we learned, Marketplace was a big contributor to Spotify's record gross profits. The key obstacle to Spotify becoming consistently profitable has been the company's low gross margin, due mainly to the fact that it pays out a large chunk of its revenue to rights holders.
One aspect of Spotify's strategy to address this issue is the two-sided marketplace. Launched in 2019, it allows artists to pay for their music to be promoted on users' homepages or within playlists. In effect, it's a way for Spotify to claw back some of the money it forks over to rights holders.
So now it finally seems to be working. In its latest earning call, Spotify gives partial credit to Marketplace for the 30.2% increase in the gross margin on the premium side of its business. Another key factor there was cost reductions, not the least of which have been the successive rounds of job cuts the company has implemented.
Ooh, yeah. The last one was that Spotify expects its podcast business to become profitable this year. So back in 2018, Spotify committed to spending $500 million to develop podcasts on the platform. By 2020, that number had grown to $800 million. And by 2022, it had spent $1.2 billion on non-music content, including a reported $100 million plus for the exclusive rights to the Joe Rogan Experience and a reported $25 million for the podcast from Barack and Michelle Obama.
So it's no doubt welcome news to hear the company's bet on podcasts is about to pay off. Daniel said this year we expect profitability for the podcast segment. So it's really a new Spotify you're seeing, where we are being relentlessly resourceful on all our costs and in driving improvements in efficiency on all of our different drivers that are adding up to this gross margin number, he said.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
What's going on there?
Yep. Our next story is from Billboard, and it's by a couple of friends of ours, actually. It's by Will Page and Fred Goldring. And the headline is How Vinyl Can Harness the Influence of Superfans. A time-tested revenue model in the theater and concert world is to price the front seats highest, right, and sell them early to the act's dedicated followers, then fill out the house with cheaper seats to optimize cash flow and lower risk. Recorded music does the opposite. When an album drops, an artist's music is immediately available on all streaming services to every subscriber, leaving no room for passionate fans to self-select into pricier options.
So in gaming, a world that I used to live in, at least since the days of Minecraft, superfans have been given early access to titles prior to their publication, generating revenue, feedback, and word of mouth. Movie studios, of course, use a similar model, charging for early access to cinema screenings of major films roughly 45 days before they are widely available to stream, typically first as a purchase, then as a rental. Apple, of course, used this windowed approach, seeking to maximize revenue with Killers of the Flower Moon and Napoleon, as did Amazon Prime with Air.
Yeah, I think you can see where this thing's going, right? The record industry seems to have missed the memo. Other than an early misfire trying out streaming exclusives on the artist-owned title service, it doesn't use a windowed approach. This is a huge missed opportunity. One way for recorded music to open a more lucrative, superfan-based future is to turn to one of the icons of its past, vinyl records. Rapper Travis Scott, he figured this out, pressing 500,000 double vinyl records of his Utopia album and making it available the same day he dropped it on streaming services. Scott has now sold the majority of them at $50 a pop, taking the risk and reaping the reward.
Wow, good for him. Yeah. What if he had released those analog vinyl records before the album was launched digitally on streaming? If he had sold half the stock before the digital release, he would have grossed $12.5 million, perhaps banking $10 million of that as profit, all while supercharging his marketing machine as all of those superfans paraded their prized product to their friends. Like the boy who cried wolf, we've been told again and again that the resurgence in vinyl is a blip, not a trend. Yet for 18 straight years, it has continued to surpass expectations. For the past 3 years, it's made up over a tenth of all label revenues from the consumer. And this year, you'll see labels reap over $1 billion vinyl dollars with no slowdown in sight.
Analog is surging in book publishing, too, as printed books are now outselling their digital counterparts 4-to-1, and bookstores are ascending. Not long ago, that would have seemed inconceivable. Now let's look at where the vinyl meets the road, the math. You know, while streaming is a music industry success story, it's also a commoditization story, selling more and more for less and less. Back in 2001, Rhapsody charged $9.99 to access 15,000 catalog songs. Today, Spotify et al. Charge roughly the same for 120 million songs. Add the impact of family plan, where typically three people share a $15 per month account, and the value of the account user has fallen by 10%. And that's before you adjust for inflation. Vinyl is bucking this trend. Since 2016, retail prices for the platters that matter have risen 30%.
For a streamer to provide a record label the same amount of value from an album as a vinyl buyer, a customer would need to press play over 5,000 times or stream for almost 2 weeks straight without sleep. They say, let's be crystal clear on what this comparison really means. Consumers are paying more for the same with vinyl, but paying less to access more with streaming. So if you want to hedge your intellectual property bets, you better put some chips on black and spin the wheel at 33 1/3. I'm going to bet you that Will wrote that.
Yeah, I think Will wrote that line. Management guru Peter Drucker once quipped that the customer rarely buys what the company thinks it's selling. In the case of vinyl, over half of buyers don't even own a record player. So they're not buying the music, they're buying merchandise that gives them a sense of identity and connection to the artist. With streaming, you merely press your thumb on a piece of glass. Owning, holding, and displaying a curated vinyl record with unique artwork has a much deeper meaning to a fan.
There are similar conundrums concerning vinyl's relationship with the creator. Remember that streaming unbundled the album, so you could have 9 filler songs on a killer number one record, yet not get paid for those songs. The book Pivot showed that Gautier's 2011 album Making Mirrors was the most streamed album of the year, but it was all down to one hit, Somebody I Used to Know, a great song, actually. Mm-hmm. Strip that hit out, and this record falls out of the top 100.
100%. Vinyl captures more of the unit value. No fan can realistically give your album $30 via streaming, and all songs receive the same payout. Saturday Night Fever soundtrack is arguably the greatest vinyl success story in history, yet the obscure Ralph McDonald track Calypso Breakdown from that album earned the same as the Bee Gees' signature track Stayin' Alive for every album sold. Investors in music catalogs should take note. Supporting more vinyl releases stands to monetize the vast majority of songs currently owned that make almost no money from streaming.
So this brings us back to the potential of vinyl's first mover advantage. Until the latter part of 2023, vinyl faced an enormous manufacturing backlog and demand far exceeded supply for even the biggest artists. Many vinyl albums were released many months after their initial streaming release, actually.
Right. A rise of small vinyl manufacturing plants have significantly decreased lag time and backlog. Travis Scott used the Poland-based team of Pressing Business to manufacture 500,000 double-disc, multi-cover, multicolored Utopia albums in just 5 weeks, allowing for the highest vinyl debut for a hip-hop artist since records began in 1991. Combined with streaming, the album stayed at number one for 5 weeks.
So they say the record industry should start selling and delivering vinyl as an early release, early access opportunity, not an afterthought. Mm. Pre-stream vinyl releases can create scarcity, exclusivity, and therefore additional revenue from superfans who will jump at the chance to be the first to hear the music or own a limited edition version. Artists will benefit creatively as well, as superfans are the ones most likely to truly appreciate the album as a body of work, curated as the artist intended, and many, many would argue, with better sound. Once music is thrown into the ocean of streaming, it often gets lost at sea, and all stakeholders holders lose something valuable. It's time for the record industry to embrace the vinyl first mover advantage that is hiding in plain sight.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just kudos to Will Page and Fred Goldring. Will Page, if you're a listener of this program, you know, you've heard him several times come on and sort of break things down for us. He's the author of Pivot, a great book, and former chief economist at Spotify. And Fred Goldring is an entrepreneur, entertainment lawyer, and co-founder of Pressing Business. So great piece, gentlemen.
Really interesting. I want to be Ralph McDonald with that last track on the album, on the Saturday Night Fever album.
I am Ralph McDonald.
Then you're living large, my friend. Living large.
Oh, my God. Okay, so our last story, and this is super important. You know, we've been talking about indie retail and record store day and the Luminate charts and how they're put together, and it's been in the news so much lately. This article, really well written by Chris Egertson over at Billboard, the headline is Luminate expands how it counts indie retail sales for Billboard charts via new partnership. And this is so important. Luminate will now collect indie physical music sales data from Street Pulse as Billboard's Tastemakers Albums chart is rebranded Indie Store Album Sales.
So Luminate, which provides data to the Billboard charts, has signed a new partnership that will enable it to report more direct U.S. independent music retail data than ever before, the company announced Wednesday. Under the partnership, which took effect April 19th and was jointly reached by the Coalition of Independent Music Stores, the Alliance of Independent Media Stores, and the Department of Record Stores, who work all together as Record Store Day, along with the Music Business Association.
Yeah, this is really great. Luminate will collect independent physical music sales from Street Pulse, the music industry data provider that receives daily sales metrics directly from these retailers. The data, which encompasses sales of CDs, vinyl, cassettes, it'll all be incorporated into the physical sales data Luminate already collects directly from other stores.
So to better recognize the impact of music sales at indie retail, Billboard has rebranded its Tastemaker Albums chart to Indie Store Album Sales. The weekly tally reflects top-selling titles at indie stores in the U.S. The news, of course, follows Luminate's controversial decision last year to retire the weighted data modeling it previously used to measure physical sales in the indie retail sector in an effort to increase the quality and accuracy of its sales metrics.
Yeah, and then there's a quote from our friend Portia Sabin. She's the president of the Music Business Association. She said, "I'd like to thank the coalitions, the retail stores, and Luminate for taking this issue seriously and working together to reach a deal." She goes on to say that sometimes it takes a pinch to bring people together. And the industry response to that unweighting of physical data was perhaps necessary to highlight the importance of that data to our industry. She said, "I'd also like to thank so many people at the labels, distributors, and even individual artists for speaking out and helping us reach an agreement, because whenever our industry comes together to achieve a common goal, it's inspiring for our future."
So Andrea Pascal of the Coalition of Independent Music Stores said this new partnership is the most significant development in the independent music retail industry since the creation of Record Store Day. "Our goal has always been to ensure comprehensive physical sales reporting and bringing in data from Street Pulse, which collects actual sales from more U.S. indie retailers than ever before, will ensure that every purchase is cataloged and counted correctly."
Yeah, and there's a great quote here from our friend Chris Muratori over at Luminate. He said that Luminate is always working towards the goal of providing quality and accurate data to the industry. Right? "We always strive to be a good partner to those across the many sectors of the music and entertainment industries, and we're happy to announce this new partnership in alignment with that mission and our values."
So Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam, who served as Record Store Day ambassador back in 2019, said in his own statement, "We truly love the independent shops. They've always meant the world to us. When it gets to this time when you can help out the community and the community record stores, it's a no-brainer."
Yeah, upon hearing about this new agreement, Pearl Jam also put out a statement from the full band, and it said that for nearly as long as we've been a band, there's been a system that worked. We're just honored to play a part so that our beloved record stores can again have a real seat at the table.
So Hannah Carlin, who's the marketing director at Secretly Group, said comprehensive sales figures are crucial for everyone, for artists and for their labels, for Luminate to provide accurate marketplace reporting, and for independent retailers who rightly own and control their data and the subsequent insights. She said physical retail remains strong and growing, and this deal will ensure that reality is reflected in sales and total consumption figures. Well, yeah. Very nice that everyone got on the same page and made yeah. that happen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so great. And, you know, a lot of hard work, Chris Muratori, you know, the fine folks over at Luminate, you and I are such huge indie record store fans.
For sure.
You know, a big shout out to Michael Kurtz, Scott Register, all those great people over there. It's so great when you have an issue like this that can be resolved, and that makes for a good week.
And relatively quickly. I mean, it wasn't all that long when things kind of became heated, and nice to see them back on the playing field and everybody working together. And on that note, we're going to wrap up the podcast. We do thank you all for listening. If you enjoy the show, of course, please tell one friend. Jay and I would certainly appreciate that. And big thanks to Bandzoogle, Hypebot, Bands in Town, and the Music Business Association for letting us stand on their very strong shoulders. And Jay and I are not that light of people, so they have strong shoulders, and we appreciate it. And all right, so everyone, hopefully everyone has a great week. We will be back next time on the Your Morning Coffee Podcast.
You've been listening to Your Morning Coffee, the weekly music news program for the new music business. Join Jay Gilbert and Mike Etchart next time for the digital music news you need to know.